sunny south-facing apartment was on the 17th floor. True, the view out east was obscured by other buildings, but to the rear, the mountains were visible in the distance.
"Now you've forgotten all your worries," my father-in-law pronounced, taking up his spoon and chopsticks. "Completely seized the moment."
Even before she got married, my sister-in-law, Inye, had managed to secure an apartment with the income she received from managing a cosmetics store. Leading up to her pregnancy, the store had expanded to 3 times its original size, and after the birth, she insisted on stopping by only at night and just for a short while, to make sure that everything was running smoothly in her absence. As soon as my nephew, Jiwoo, turned 3 and went to a nursery, she'd apparently started spending all day in the shop again. I envied her husband. He was an art college graduate who liked to pose as an artist, yet didn't contribute a single penny to their household finances. True, he had some property that he'd inherited, but he didn't bring in a salary. In fact, his activities were limited to sitting around and not doing an awful lot of anything. Now that Inye had rolled up her sleeves and gone back to work, her husband was free to spend his whole life messing about with art, without a single worry to trouble his comfortable existence. Not only that, but Inye was also a skilled cook, just as my wife used to be. Seeing the lunch table she had swiftly set made me feel a sudden pang of hunger. Taking in her nicely filled-out figure, big double-lidded eyes, and demure manner of speaking, I sorely regretted the many things it seemed I'd ended up losing somehow or other to have left me in my current plight. Neither complimenting the house nor thanking her sister for taking the trouble to prepare the food, my wife sat quietly eating rice and kimchi. Those were the only things she touched. Mayonnaise contained eggs, so that was another thing off the menu for her. She didn't so much as stick her chopsticks into the mouth-watering salad. Her face was blanched, a result of protracted insomnia. A stranger coming across her in the street would have assumed she was a hospital patient. A little earlier, pretty much as soon as we'd both come in through the front door, she'd been summoned to the master bedroom. After a while, my sister-in-law was the first to emerge, and judging from her baffled expression, I guessed that my wife had come out without a bra. Sure enough, when I looked closely, I could see her light brown nipples showing through like smudges on the cotton. "How much was the deposit here?"
"Really? We went to look at the real estate site yesterday. This apartment had already gone up to around 50 million won, because next year they will have completed the underground line extension, you see."
"My brother-in-law certainly has a good head for this kind of thing." "What did I do? It was all down to my wife."
While our polite, amiable conversation carried on in intermittent bursts, the children seemed unable to sit still, hitting each other and making an almighty racket, pausing only to stuff their mouths with food.
"Sister-in-law," I asked, "did you prepare all this food yourself?"
She gave me a half smile.
"Well, I've been doing it bit by bit since the day before yesterday. And those, the seasoned oysters, I went to the market expressly to get because I know Young-hye likes them, and she hasn't even touched them."
I held my breath. Here it comes, I thought.
"Enough," my father-in-law yelled. "You, Young-hye, after all I told you, your own father!"
This outburst was followed by Inhe's roundly rebuking my wife.
"Do you truly intend to go on like this? Human beings need certain nutrients. If you intend to follow a vegetarian diet, you should sit down and draw up a proper, well-balanced meal plan. Just look at your face."
So far, my wife's brother, Young Ho, was keeping his own counsel, so his wife decided to have her say instead.
"When I saw her, I thought she was a different person. I'd heard about it from my husband, but I never would have guessed that going vegetarian could damage your body like that."
My mother-in-law brought in dishes of stir-fried beef, sweet and sour pork, steamed chicken, and octopus noodles, arranging them on the table in front of my wife.
"This whole vegetarian business stops right now," she said. "This one and this, hurry up and eat them. How could you have got into this wretched state when there's not a thing in the world you can't eat?"
"Well, what are you waiting for? Come on, eat up!" my father-in-law boomed.
"You must eat, Young-hye," Inye admonished. You'll have more energy if you do. Everyone needs a certain amount of energy while they're alive. Even priests who enter the temple don't take their austerities too far. They might be celibate, but they're still able to live active lives.
The children were staring wide-eyed at my wife. She turned her blank gaze on her family as if she couldn't fathom the reason for all this sudden fuss. A strained silence ensued. I surveyed in turn my father-in-law's swarthy cheeks, my mother-in-law's face, so full of wrinkles I couldn't believe it had once been that of a young woman, her eyes filled with worry. Inye's anxiously raised eyebrows, her husband's affected attitude of being no more than a casual bystander, the passive but seemingly displeased expressions of Young-ho and his wife. I expected my wife to say something in her own defense, but the sole silent answer she made to all those glaring faces was to set the pair of chopsticks she had picked up back down on the table. A small flurry of unease ran through the assembled family. This time, my mother-in-law picked up some sweet and sour pork with her chopsticks and thrust it right up in front of my wife's mouth, saying, "Here, come on, hurry up and eat." Mouth closed, my wife stared at her mother as though entirely ignorant of the rules of etiquette.
"Open your mouth right now. You don't like it? Well, try this instead, then."
She tried the same thing with stir-fried beef, and when my wife kept her mouth shut just as before, set the beef down and picked up some dressed oysters.
"Haven't you liked these since you were little? You used to want to eat them all the time."
"Yes, I remember that too," Inye chimed in, backing up her mother by making it seem as though my wife's not eating oysters were the ultimate big deal.
"I always thought of you when I see oysters, Young-ye."
As the chopsticks holding the dressed oysters gradually neared my wife's averted mouth, she twisted away violently.
"Eat it quickly! My arm hurts!"
My mother-in-law's arm was actually trembling. Eventually, my wife stood up.
"I won't eat it."
For the first time in a long while, her speech was clear and distinct.
"What?"
My wife's father and brother, who were both similarly hot-tempered, yelled in concert. Young-ho's wife quickly grabbed her husband's arm.
"My heart will pack in if this goes on any longer," my father-in-law shouted at Young-ye. "Don't you understand what your father's telling you? If he tells you to eat, you eat!"
I expected an answer from my wife along the lines of, "I'm sorry, father, but I just can't eat it." But all she said was,
"I do not eat meat."
Clearly enunciated, and seemingly not the least bit apologetic. My mother-in-law gathered up the chopsticks with an attitude of despair. Her old woman's face seemed on the brink of crumpling into tears, tears that would explode from her eyes and then course down her wrinkled cheeks in silence. My father-in-law took up a pair of chopsticks. He used them to pick up a piece of sweet and sour pork and stood tall in front of my wife, who turned away. My father-in-law stooped slightly as he thrust the pork in my wife's face, a lifetime's rigid discipline unable to disguise his advanced age.
"Eat it! Listen to what your father's telling you and eat! Everything I say is for your own good, so why act like this if it makes you ill?"
The fatherly affection that was almost choking the old man made a powerful impression on me, and I was moved to tears in spite of myself. Probably everyone gathered there felt the same. With one hand, my wife pushed away his chopsticks, which were shaking silently in empty space.
"Father, I don't eat meat."
In an instant, his flat palm cleaved the empty space. My wife cupped her cheek in her hand.
"Father!"
Inye cried out, grabbing his arm. His lips twitched as though his agitation had not yet passed off. I'd known of his incredibly violent temperament for some time, but it was the first time I directly witnessed him striking someone.
"Mr. Chung, Young-ho, the two of you, come here."
I approached my wife hesitantly. He'd hit her so hard that the blood showed through the skin of her cheek. Her breathing was ragged, and it seemed that her composure had finally been shattered.
"Take hold of Young-he's arms, both of you."
"What?"
"If she eats it once, she'll eat it again. It's preposterous. Everyone eats meat."
Young-ho stood up, looking as though he were finding this whole episode distasteful.
"Sister, would you please just eat? Or after all, it would be simple enough just to pretend. Do you have to make such a thing about it in front of Father?"
"What kind of talk is that?" my father-in-law yelled. "Grab her arms, quickly! You too, Mr. Chung!"
"Father, why are you doing this?"
Inhye took hold of her father's right arm. Having thrown down the chopsticks, he now picked up a piece of pork with his fingers and approached my wife. She was hesitantly backing away when her brother seized her and sat her down.
"Sister, just behave, okay? Just eat what he gives you." "Father, I beg you to stop this,"
Inhye entreated him, but he shook her off and thrust the pork at my wife's lips. A moaning sound came from her tightly closed mouth. She was unable to say even a single word in case, when she opened her mouth to speak, the meat found its way in.
"Father!"
Young-ho shouted, apparently wanting to dissuade him, though he himself didn't release his grip on my wife. My father-in-law mashed the pork to a pulp on my wife's lips as she struggled in agony. Though he parted her lips with his strong fingers, he could do nothing about her clenched teeth. Eventually he flew into a passion again and struck her in the face once more.
"Father!"
Though Inhye sprang at him and held him by the waist, in the instant that the force of the slap had knocked my wife's mouth open, he'd managed to jam the pork in. As soon as the strength in Young-ho's arms was visibly exhausted, my wife growled and spat out the meat. An animal cry of distress burst from her lips.
"Get away!"
At first, she drew up her shoulders and seemed about to flee in the direction of the front door, but then she turned back and picked up the fruit knife that had been lying on the dining table.
"Young-ye?"
My mother-in-law's voice, which seemed about to break, drew a trembling line through the brutal silence. The children burst into noisy sobbing, unable to suppress it any longer. Jaw clenched, her intent stare facing each one of us down in turn, my wife brandished the knife.
"Stop her! Stay back!"
Blood ribboned out of her wrist. The shock of red splashed over white china. As her knees buckled as she crumpled to the floor, the knife was wrested from her by Inhye's husband, who until then had sat through the whole thing as an idle spectator.
"What are you doing? Somebody fetch a towel at least!"
Every inch the Special Forces graduate, he stopped the bleeding with practiced skill and picked my wife up in his arms.
"Quickly, go down and start the engine."
I groped for my shoes. The ones I'd picked up weren't a pair, so I had to swap them before I was able to open the front door and go out.
The dog that sank its teeth into my leg is chained up to Father's motorcycle. With its singed tail bandaged to my calf wound, a traditional remedy Mother insisted on, I go out and stand at the main gate. I am 9 years old, and the summer heat is stifling. The sun has gone down, and still the sweat is running off me. The dog, too, is panting, its red tongue lolling. A white, handsome-looking dog, bigger even than me. Up until it bit the big man's daughter, everyone in the village always thought it could do no wrong. While Father ties the dog to the tree and scorches it with a lamp, he says it isn't to be flogged. He says he heard somewhere that driving a dog to keep running until the point of death is considered a milder punishment. The motorcycle engine starts, and Father begins to drive in a circle. The dog runs along behind. 2 laps, 3 laps, they circle around. Without moving a muscle, I stand just inside the gate, watching Whitey, eyes rolling and gasping for breath, gradually exhaust himself. Every time his gleaming eyes meet my own, I glare even more fiercely. Bad dog, you'd bite me? Once it has gone 5 laps, The dog is frothing at the mouth. Blood drips from its throat, which is being choked with the rope. Constantly groaning through its damaged throat, the dog is dragged along the ground. At 6 laps, the dog vomits blackish-red blood, trickling from its mouth and open throat. As blood and froth mix together, I stand stiffly upright and stare at those two glittering eyes. 7 laps, and while waiting for the dog to come into view, Father looks behind and sees that it is in fact dangling limply from the motorcycle. I look at the dog's 4 juddering legs, its raised eyelids, the blood and water in its dead eyes. That evening, there was a feast at our house. All the middle-aged men from the market alleyways came, everyone my father considered worth knowing. The saying goes that for a wound caused by a dog bite to heal, you have to eat that same dog, and I did scoop up a mouthful for myself. No, in fact, I ate an entire bowlful with rice. The smell of burnt flesh, which the perilla seeds couldn't wholly mask, pricked my nose. I remember the 2 eyes that had watched me, while the dog was made to run on, while he vomited blood mixed with froth, and how later they had seemed to appear, flickering, on the surface of the soup. But I don't care. I really didn't care.
The women stayed behind in the house in order to calm the children down. Young Ho saw to my mother-in-law, who had fainted, and my brother-in-law and I took my wife to the casualty department of a nearby hospital. Now no longer in a critical condition, she was transferred to a general 2-patient room, and only then did we 2 men become aware that our clothes were stained with dried blood. My wife fell asleep with an IV needle inserted into her right arm. The 2 of us observed her sleeping face in silence, as though some sort of solution were inscribed there. As though, if I only kept on examining her face, I would be able to figure out the answer. "Could you step outside for a moment?" I asked my brother-in-law. His expression suggested that he had something he wanted to get off his chest, but he limited himself to a noncommittal, "All right." I pulled out Juan from my pocket, which was all I could find in there, and handed it over. "Please use this to buy a set of clothes from the store." "Me? My wife will bring me some clean clothes when she comes around later." Young Ho and his wife showed up that evening with Inye. Apparently my father-in-law still hadn't calmed down. Their mother kept stubbornly insisting on coming to the hospital, but Young Ho was adamant that she wasn't to go anywhere near the place. "What on earth went on back there?" Young Ho's wife exclaimed. "And right in front of the children." She must have been crying as her makeup had run and her eyes were swollen. "Your father went too far, you know. How can he hit his daughter in front of her husband? Has he always been like this?" "Of course he's always been quick-tempered," Inhye admitted. "Haven't you seen how Young Ho takes after him? But still, now he's older, it's not so bad." Young Ho looked put out. "Why are you putting the blame on me?" "Though after all," Inhye continued, ignoring him, "Young Ho refused to say a single word to him, so he was bound to get upset, you know. I mean, she is his daughter." Force-feeding her meat was certainly taking it too far, but what made her decide to stop eating it in the first place? And then why the knife? I've never seen such a thing in all my life. However will she look her husband in the face? Young Ho's wife looked still half in shock. While Inhye was examining my wife, I changed into her husband's t-shirt and went to the sauna upstairs. I washed off the black congealed blood under the shower's lukewarm stream of water. I looked at myself in the mirror, frowning. The whole affair made my flesh crawl. It just didn't seem real. Right then, thinking about my wife didn't cause me shock or confusion so much as an intense feeling of disgust. After Inhye had gone home, the only people left in the general ward aside from my wife and me were a schoolgirl who'd been admitted with a ruptured intestine and her parents. They kept on darting sideways glances at me while I stood watch at my wife's bedside, and I could see perfectly well that they were whispering together. But any minute now this long Sunday would be over, and Monday would begin, which meant I would no longer have to look at this woman. I expected that Young Ho would take my place, and that the day after tomorrow my wife would be discharged. Discharged. In other words, I would once again have to live with this strange, frightening woman, the two of us in the same house. It was a prospect I found difficult to contemplate. At 9 o'clock the next evening, I visited the ward. Young Ho greeted me with a smile.
"You must be tired, no?" he said.
"How are the children?" "Jiwoo's dad's staying with them today." If only my colleagues had decided to go for drinks after work, I would have had the perfect excuse to avoid the ward for another 2 hours. But it was Monday, so there was no chance of any such reprieve. "How's my wife been?" "She's just been sleeping. You can see that without having to ask. She ate what they gave her. It seems she's going to be okay." Young Ho was clearly trying to be considerate, and he did manage to soothe my sharp mood a little. A short while after he left, and just as I was thinking to myself that I ought to loosen my tie and freshen up, someone knocked on the door of the ward. To my surprise, it was my mother-in-law.
"I'm so ashamed to face you," she began babbling as soon as she came near me.
"There's no need for that. How are you?" She took a deep breath.
"Well, you see how it is with old age. The slightest shock."
She'd brought a shopping bag with her, which she now thrust at me. "What's this?"
"Something I prepared before we came up to Seoul. You waste away after months without meat, it seems, so eat this together, the two of you. It's black goat. I was afraid that if Inhye and her husband found out, they might try and stop me from coming. Try feeding it to Younghye. Just tell her it's herbal medicine. I put a load of medicinal stuff in to mask the smell. She's become such a scrawny thing, just a ghost, and now what with losing all that blood?"
I was beginning to get sick and tired of this stubborn maternal affection.
"There's no stovetop here, is there? I'll go and see if they have one in the nurse's room."
She took one of the packets out of her bag and left. Repeatedly winding my tie around my hand and clenching it into a ball, I felt myself get more and more worked up as the irritation returned that Young Ho had briefly appeased. Luckily, a short while later, my wife woke up. Only then, when I realized how much better this was than if she'd woken up when I was there alone, did my mother-in-law's arrival come to seem like a good thing. My mother-in-law came back, and was the first thing my wife's eyes fixed on. The older woman's face was wreathed in smiles from the moment she opened the door, whereas my wife's expression was difficult to decipher. She spent all day lying in bed, and now, whether because of the drip or simply due to swelling, her face was practically bloodless, almost as white as milk. Holding a steaming paper cup in one hand, my mother-in-law grasped my wife's hand in the other.
"This," her eyes welled with tears, "take this. Ah, look at your face."
My wife obediently took the paper cup.
"It's herbal medicine. They say it strengthens the body. Why, in the old days, back before your marriage, we had the very same medicine made up for you, remember?"
My wife sniffed it and shook her head.
"This isn't herbal medicine."
Her expression cheerless and indifferent, and her eyes filled with something strangely like pity, my wife handed the cup back to her mother.
"It is herbal medicine. Just hold your nose and drink it down quickly."
"I'm not drinking it."
"Drink it. This is your mother's wish. Even the dead get their wishes obeyed, but you'd ignore your own mother's?"
She held the cup to my wife's lips.
"Is it really herbal medicine?" "Of course. I just said so."
My wife held her nose and took a sip of the black liquid. My mother-in-law was all smiles, exclaiming,
"More, drink more."
Her eyes flashed below their wrinkled lids.
"I'll keep it here and drink it a little later."
My wife lay back down again.
"What would you like to eat? Shall I buy something sweet to take away the aftertaste?"
"I'm all right." All the same, the old woman kept on pestering me to go and find a shop. I refused to be harried into going, and eventually she left the room to find a shop herself. Then my wife pushed her blanket aside and got up.
Where are you going?
The bathroom.
I picked up the IV bag and followed after her. She hung the bag up inside the toilet and locked the door, and then, accompanied by several groans, vomited up everything in her stomach. She staggered out of the toilet, trailing the faint smell of gastric juices and the sour tang of semi-digested food. As I hadn't done it for her, she was forced to pick up her IV bag with her bandaged left hand, but she didn't hold it high enough, and a small amount of blood began to flow back down the tube. Tottering forward, she picked up the bag of black goat her mother had set down by the bed. Her right hand, which clutched the heavy bag, still had the IV needle embedded in it, but she didn't pay this the slightest bit of notice. Then she left the ward, and I had absolutely no desire to go and find out what she was up to. After a little while, the door banged loudly enough to make the schoolgirl and her mother frown in disapproval, and my mother-in-law burst in. She had a packet of cookies in one hand, and the paper shopping bag in the other. I could see even at a glance that the black liquid had burst out.
Mr. Chung, what on earth were you thinking of, just sitting there like that? Didn't you guess what that child might have been planning?
More than anything else, I was strongly tempted just to walk out of the ward and go home.
You, Young-hye, do you know how much this is worth? Would you throw it away? Money scraped together with your own parents' sweat and blood. How can you call yourself my daughter?
The moment I saw my wife, bent at the waist, I noticed her red blood trickling backward into the IV bag.
Look at yourself now! Stop eating meat and the world will devour you whole! Take a look in the mirror. Go on. Tell me what you look like.
Finally, her high-pitched screeching subsided into low sobs. But my wife merely gazed at the sobbing woman as though she were a complete stranger, and eventually, as if having decided that this performance had gone on quite long enough, got back up onto the bed. She pulled the blanket up to her chest and closed her eyes. Only then did I raise the IV bag, now half full of crimson blood.
I don't know why that woman is crying. I don't know why she keeps staring at my face either, as though she wants to swallow it. Or why she strokes the bandage on my wrist with her trembling hands. My wrist is okay. It doesn't bother me. The thing that hurts is my chest. Something is stuck in my solar plexus. I don't know what it might be. It's lodged there permanently these days. Even though I've stopped wearing a bra, I can feel this lump all the time. No matter how deeply I inhale, it doesn't go away. Yells and howls, threaded together, layer upon layer, are enmeshed to form that lump. Because of meat. I ate too much meat. The lives of the animals I ate have all lodged there. Blood and flesh, all those butchered bodies are scattered in every nook and cranny, and though the physical remnants were excreted, their lives still stick stubbornly to my insides. One time, just one more time, I want to shout. I want to throw myself through the pitch-black window. Maybe that would finally get this lump out of my body. Yes, perhaps that might work. Nobody can help me. Nobody can save me. Nobody can make me breathe.
I packed my mother-in-law off in a taxi, and when I got back, the ward was dark. The schoolgirl and her mother, presumably fed up with all the commotion, had turned off the television and lights a little ahead of time and drawn their curtain. My wife was sleeping. I lay down awkwardly on the cramped side bed and tried to fall asleep. I had absolutely no idea how I was going to sort this mess out. Only one thing was clear, and that was that this whole affair was bound to cause me no end of trouble. When I eventually succeeded in falling asleep, I had a dream. In the dream, I was killing someone. I thrust a knife into their stomach with all my strength, then reached into the wound and wrenched out the long, coiled-up intestines. Like eating fish, I peeled off all the squishy flesh and muscle and left only the bones. But in the very instant I woke up, I ceased to remember who it was that I had killed. It was early in the morning, still dark. Driven by a strange compulsion, I pulled back the blanket covering my wife. I fumbled in the pitch-black darkness, but there was no watery blood, no ripped intestines. I could hear the other patient's sleeping breath coming in little gasps, but my wife was unnaturally silent. I felt an odd trembling inside myself, and reached out with my index finger to touch her philtrum. She was alive. When I woke up again, the ward was already light.
"Goodness, you've been sleeping so deeply," the young girl's mother said. "You didn't even wake up when they came and brought the food."
She sounded as though she felt rather sorry for me. I saw the meal tray that had been left on the bed. My wife hadn't even opened the rice bowl, had left the meal tray untouched, and gone... where? The IV had been pulled out too, and the bloody needle was dangling from the end of the long plastic tube.
"Where did she go?"
I asked, wiping away the traces of drool from around my mouth.
"She was already gone when we woke up."
"What?
In that case, you should have woken me, you know."
"Even if I try to, you sleep like a log. Of course, I would have woken you if it had seemed like something had happened." Her face reddened, either from anger or simple confusion. I adjusted my clothes and rushed out, looking around impatiently as I passed down the corridor and came to the lift, but my wife was nowhere to be seen. I didn't have time for this. I told them at the office that I'd be 2 hours later than usual getting in. Right now, my wife should already have been being discharged. I decided that when I took her home, I would tell her, and indeed myself, that we should just think of the whole thing as a bad dream. I took the lift down to the ground floor. She wasn't in the lobby, so I hurried out into the hospital garden, out of breath, but making sure to scan the area thoroughly. The only people in the garden were those patients who had already finished their breakfast. The early morning chill, which would pass off soon enough, was fairly mild even now. You could tell who was a long-term patient based on how they looked, whether fatigued and gloomy or peaceful. As I drew near the fountain, which was dry, I noticed that there was some kind of commotion. The people gathered there were all looking at something. I pushed my way through them until I had a clear view. My wife was sitting on a bench by the fountain. She had removed her hospital gown and placed it on her knees, leaving her gaunt collarbones, emaciated breasts, and brown nipples completely exposed. The bandage had been unwound from her left wrist, and the blood that was leaking out seemed to be slowly licking at the sutured area. Sunbeams bathed her face and naked body.
"How long has she been sitting there like that? Good grief! She looks like she's come from the psychiatric ward, this young woman. What's that she's holding? It looks like she's gripping something. Ah, look over there. They're coming now."
When I turned to look over my shoulder, a male nurse and a middle-aged guard could be seen hurrying over, their faces grave. I looked at my wife's exhausted face, her lips stained with blood like clumsily applied lipstick. Her eyes, which had been staring fixedly at the gathered audience, met mine. They glittered, as though filled with water. I thought to myself, "I do not know that woman." And it was true. It was not a lie. Nevertheless, and compelled by responsibilities that refused to be shirked, my legs carried me toward her, a movement that I could not for the life of me control.
"Darling, what are you doing?"
I murmured in a low voice, picking up the hospital gown and using it to cover her bare chest.
"It's hot, so..."
She smiled faintly, her familiar smile, a smile that could not have been more ordinary, and which I had believed I knew so well.
"It's hot, so I just got undressed."
She raised her left hand to shield her forehead from the streaming sunlight, revealing the cuts on her wrist.
"Have I done something wrong?"
I prized open her clenched right hand. A bird, which had been crushed in her grip, tumbled to the bench. It was a small white-eyed bird, with feathers missing here and there, Below tooth marks that looked to have been caused by a predator's bite, vivid red bloodstains were spreading.
2. Mongolian mark.
The deep oxblood curtain fell over the stage. The dancers waved their hands so vigorously the whole row became a blur of movement, with individual figures impossible to make out. Though the applause was loud, with even the odd shout of "Bravo!" thrown in here and there, there was no curtain call. The ovation abruptly subsided, and the audience began to gather up their bags and jackets and make their way to the aisles. He uncrossed his legs and stood up. He kept his arms folded during the 5 or so minutes of applause, silently gazing up at the dancers' eager faces as they greedily drank it in. Their efforts had inspired in him both compassion and respect, but the choreographer, he felt, hadn't deserved his applause. He exited the auditorium and crossed the foyer, studying the now obsolete performance posters. He'd been in a bookshop in the city center when he'd happened upon one of the posters, the sight of which had sent a shiver through his body. Worried that he might have missed the last performance, he hurriedly phoned the theater and made a reservation. On the poster, men and women sat displaying their naked backs, which were covered from the napes of their necks right down to their bottoms with flowers, coiling stems and thickly overlapping petals, painted on in red and blue. Looking at them, he felt afraid, excited, and somehow oppressed. He couldn't believe that the image that had obsessed him for almost a year now had also been dreamed up by someone else, the choreographer, someone, moreover, whom he'd never even heard of. Was that image really about to unfold in front of him, just as he'd dreamed it? Sitting in his seat waiting for the lights to go down and the performance to start, he'd been so nervous he couldn't even take a sip of water. But he hadn't found what he'd been looking for. Threading his way through the crowds of theatergoers who had thronged into the foyer and who all looked so dazzling and extroverted, he headed for the exit nearest to the underground station. There had been nothing for him in the booming electronic music, the gaudy costumes, the showy nudity, or the overtly sexual gestures. The thing he'd been searching for was something quieter, deeper, more private. He had to wait a while for a train, it being a Sunday afternoon, and when he got on, he stood near the carriage door, holding a program with a photograph from the posters printed on its cover. His wife and 5-year-old son were waiting at home. His wife, he knew, would have liked for them to spend weekends together as a family, but all the same, he set aside a half day to see the performance. Would he get anything out of it? He'd known that, more than likely, he would only end up disillusioned yet again, that in the end, it was the only possible outcome. And now that was exactly what had happened. How on earth could a complete stranger be expected to tease out the inner logic of something he himself had dreamed up, to find a way to make it come alive? The bitterness that suddenly welled up inside him was exactly the same as the feeling he'd experienced a long time ago on watching a video work by the Japanese artist Yayoi Kusama. The work had been filled with scenes of promiscuous sexual practices featuring around 10 men and women, each of them daubed all over with colored paint, their greed for each other's bodies playing out against the background of psychedelic music. They never stopped moving the whole time, flailing and floundering like fish out of water. Not that his own thirst was any less strong, of course, only he didn't want to express it like that. Anything but that. After a while, the train went past the apartment complex where he lived. He'd never had any intention of getting off there. He stuffed the program into his backpack, rammed both fists into the pockets of his sweater, and studied the interior of the carriage as it was reflected in the window. He had to force himself to accept that the middle-aged man who had a baseball cap concealing his receding hairline and a baggy sweater, at least attempting to do the same for his paunch, was himself. As luck would have it, the door to the studio was locked, which meant he had the place to himself. Sunday afternoons were practically the only times when he could use the space undisturbed. It was a small studio on the 2nd floor below ground level of K Group's headquarters, provided as part of their corporate sponsorship drive. The four video artists who shared the space had to take it in turns to use the single computer. He was grateful to be able to use the overhead equipment free of charge, but his sensitivity to the presence of others, which meant that he could only become properly absorbed in his work when he was alone, was a major stumbling block. The door opened with a small click. He groped along the wall until he found the light switch. Making sure to lock the door behind him first of all, he took off his cap and sweater, put his bag down on the floor, then proceeded to pace up and down the narrow studio corridor for a while, his hands over his mouth, before finally slumping down in front of the computer and putting his head in his hands. He opened his bag and got out the program, his sketchbook and master tape. On that tape, which was labeled with his name, address, and phone number, were the originals of every video work he'd made over the past 10 years or so. It had already been 2 years since he'd last stored a new work on the tape. Not that 2 years was considered terminal as far as fallow periods went, but it was still long enough to make him anxious. He opened the sketchbook. The drawings filled scores of pages, and despite being based on fundamentally the same idea, were completely different from the performance poster in terms of atmosphere and artistic feel. The naked bodies of the men and women were brilliantly decorated, covered all over in painted flowers, and there was something simple and straightforward about the ways in which they were having sex. Without the taut buttocks, tensed inner thighs, and the skinny upper bodies that gave them a dancer's physique, there would have been no more suggestiveness about them than there was with spring flowers. Their bodies, he hadn't drawn in faces, had a stillness and solidity that counterbalanced the arousing nature of the situation. The image had come to him in a flash of inspiration. It had happened last winter when he'd started to believe that he might somehow be able to bring his 2-year-long fallow period to an end, when he'd felt energy start to wriggle up from the pit of his stomach, bit by bit. But how could he have known this energy would coalesce into such a preposterous image? For one thing, up until then his work had always tended toward realism. And so, for someone who had previously worked on 3D graphics of people worn down by the vicissitudes of late capitalist society, to be screened as factual documentaries, the carnality, the pure sensuality of this image was nothing short of monstrous. And the image might never have come to him if it hadn't been for a chance conversation. Had his wife not asked him to give their son a bath that Sunday afternoon? Had he not watched her helping their son to pull on his underpants after toweling him dry and been moved to exclaim, "That Mongolian mark is still so big! When on earth do they fade away?" Had she not replied thoughtlessly, "Well, I can't remember exactly when mine went, and Yongye still had hers when she was 20. If she hadn't then followed up his astonished 20 with, just a thumb-sized thing, blue. And if she had it that long, who knows, maybe she still got it now. In precisely that moment, he was struck by the image of a blue flower on a woman's buttocks, its petals opening outward. In his mind, the fact that his sister-in-law still had a Mongolian mark on her buttocks became inexplicably bound up with the image of men and women having sex, their naked bodies completely covered with painted flowers. The causality linking these two things was so clear, so obvious, as to be somehow beyond comprehension, and thus it became etched into his mind. Though her face was missing, the woman in his sketch was undoubtedly his sister-in-law. No, it had to be her. He'd imagined what her naked body must look like and began to draw, finishing it off with a dot like a small blue petal in the middle of her buttocks, and he'd got an erection. It was almost the first time since his marriage, and definitely the first time since he'd said goodbye to his mid-30s, that he'd felt such intense sexual desire, a desire which, moreover, was focused on a clear object. And so who was the faceless man with his arms around her neck, looking as if he were attempting to throttle her, who was thrusting himself into her? He knew that it was himself, that in fact it could be none other. Arriving at this conclusion, he grimaced. He spent a long time searching for a solution, for a way to free himself from the hold this image had on him, but nothing else would do as a substitute. Another image as intense and enticing as this one simply didn't exist. There was no other work he wanted to do. Every exhibition, film, performance, came to feel dull and flat, for no other reason than that it wasn't this. He spent hours, seemingly lost in a daydream, mulling over how to make the image become a reality. He would rent a studio from his painter friend and install lighting, get some body paints and a white sheet to cover the floor. He let his thoughts run on like this, even though the most important thing, persuading his sister-in-law, still remained to be done. He agonized for a long time over whether he might be able to replace her with another woman, when the suspicion occurred to him, somewhat belatedly, that the film he was planning could all too easily be categorized as pornography. Never mind his sister-in-law, no woman would agree to such a thing. In that case, should he shell out a large sum of money to hire a professional actress? Even if, after making 100 concessions, he eventually managed to get the thing filmed, would he really be able to exhibit it? He'd often anticipated that his work, which dealt with social issues, might put him in the firing line with some people, but never before had he imagined himself being branded as some peddler of cheap titillation. He'd always been completely unrestricted when it came to making his art, and so it hadn't ever really occurred to him that this freedom might become a luxury. If it hadn't been for the image, he would never have had to go through all this anxiety, this discomfort and unease, this agonizing doubt and self-examination. He wouldn't have had to suffer the fear of losing everything he'd achieved. Not that that really amounted to all that much. Even his family, in one fell swoop, and due to a choice that he himself had made. He was becoming divided against himself. Was he a normal human being? More than that, a moral human being. A strong human being, able to control his own impulses? In the end, he found himself unable to claim with any certainty that he knew the answers to these questions, though he'd been so sure before. He heard the click of keys in the lock, quickly covered the sketchbook, and turned to face the door. Whoever it was, he didn't want his drawings to catch his or her eye. This was something new and a little strange for him. He never usually held back when it came to showing his sketches or concepts to other people. "Hey!" It was Jay, his long hair tied back in a ponytail. "I didn't think there was anyone in here." He leaned back, keeping his movements deliberately slow, and laughed. "Fancy a cup of coffee?" Jay asked, fishing some coins out of his pocket. He shook his head. While Jay went to get a coffee from the vending machine, he looked around the studio, now no longer his own private space. He put his baseball cap back on, uncomfortable at the thought of his balding crown being on show. Like a cough that tickles the throat, he could feel a long-suppressed yell threatening to burst out from deep inside him. He swept his things into his bag and fled the studio, hurrying toward the lift. In his reflection in the lift's door, which gleamed like a mirror, it looked as though tears were streaming from his bloodshot eyes. However much he combed his memory, he couldn't recall anything like this having happened to him before. Right at that moment, he wanted nothing more than to spit at those red-lined eyes. He wanted to pummel his cheeks until the blood showed through beneath his black beard and smash his ugly lips, swollen with desire, with the sole of his shoe. "You're late," his wife said, making an effort not to sound too put out. Their son turned back to the plastic forklift truck he'd been playing with. It was impossible to tell whether or not he was glad to see his father. Since his wife had gone back to working full-time at her cosmetic store, she was constantly exhausted, but she was the type to press on regardless, diligent and persevering. Practically, the only thing she asked of him was to keep Sunday daytimes free. "I'd like to have a bit of rest myself, and our son needs to spend time with his father too, doesn't he?" He knew that this was the only time of the week she would allow herself a bit of a break. She was even grateful that he let her take on so much responsibility, running a business as well as a household, without so much as a word of complaint. But these days, every time he looked at her, he saw her sister's face overlaid on hers, and their domestic life couldn't have been further from his thoughts.
"Have you had dinner?"
"Yeah, I grabbed something on the way."
"You have to eat properly. Why do you always just grab something on the go?"
Her tone was resigned, as though she'd long given her husband up as a lost cause. He examined her exhausted-looking face the way one might look at a complete stranger. Her eyes were deep and clear, framed by naturally double eyelids, and her face was a slender oval, with a smooth, feminine jawline. The success of the cosmetic store, which had expanded over the years from the 2.5 pyeong space which she'd somehow managed to set up when she was still a young girl, must have been largely down to the impression of affability which these pleasant, open features gave. And yet, right from the first, there had been something about her that left him feeling vaguely dissatisfied. Her face, figure, and thoughtful nature all combined to form the spitting image of the woman he'd spent so long trying to find. And so, unable to put his finger on just what it was that he felt she was lacking, he'd made up his mind to marry her. In fact, it was only when he was introduced to her sister that he realized what it was his new wife was missing. Everything about her sister pleased him. Her single-lidded eyes, the way she spoke, so blunt as to be almost uncouth, and without his wife's faintly nasal inflection. Her drab clothes, her androgynously protruding cheekbones. She might well be called ugly in comparison with his wife, but to him, she radiated energy, like a tree that grows in the wilderness, denuded and solitary. All the same, he felt no different toward her than he had before they'd met. Huh. Now she's my type. Even though they're sisters and they're quite similar in many ways, there's some subtle difference between them. This thought flitted briefly through his mind and was gone. Shall I make you something to eat or not? His wife's question was almost a demand. I told you I've already eaten. Exhausted from all the emotions roiling inside him, he opened the bathroom door. As soon as he turned the light on, his wife's voice drilled into his ears once more. On top of everything else, I'm worried about Yongye. I didn't hear from you all day, and Jiwoo has a cold, so I had to stay with him all the time. Her sigh was followed by a shout directed at their son. What are you doing? I told you to come and take your medicine. Knowing that the boy would dawdle, his wife slowly poured the powdered medicine onto a spoon and mixed it with a strawberry-colored syrup. He emerged from the bathroom and closed the door behind him. What about your sister? He asked his wife. What's happened now? She finally got served with the divorce papers, of course. It's not that I don't understand Mr. Chung's position, but all the same, he could have shown a bit more sympathy to just throw away a marriage like that. He stammered. Shall I call around and see her? His wife suddenly became animated. Would you? We haven't had her around in such a long time, and if you were to go and see her, even if it's a bit awkward. But you know, it's not as though she doesn't understand the difficulty. She knows that's just how things turned out. He studied his wife, a picture of responsible compassion, as she carefully approached their son with the medicine. She's a good woman, he thought, the kind of woman whose goodness is oppressive. I'll give her a call tomorrow. Do you need the number? No, I've got it. Feeling as though his chest might be about to burst, he went back inside the bathroom and closed the door. He turned on the shower and listened to the water drumming down into the bathtub as he took off his clothes. He was aware that he hadn't had sex with his wife for close on 2 months, but he also knew that his penis's sudden rigidity was nothing to do with her. He pictured to himself his sister-in-law's rented studio apartment, the one she'd shared with his wife back when they were young, pictured her curled up there on the bed, then switched to remembering how it had felt to carry her on his back, her body pressed up against his, and staining his clothes with her blood, the feel of her chest and buttocks, imagined himself pulling down her trousers just enough to reveal the blue brand of the Mongolian mark. He stood there and masturbated. A moan escaped from between his lips, not quite laughter and not quite a sob. The shock of the too cold water. It had been the beginning of summer 2 years ago when his sister-in-law had cut her wrist open in his house. They'd moved there only recently, wanting the extra floor space, and his wife's family had all come around for lunch. He'd heard about his sister-in-law apparently turning vegetarian, something that hadn't sat at all well with his family of meat lovers, the father in particular. She'd been so pitifully thin, It wasn't as though he couldn't understand them giving her a strict dressing down, but that her father, the Vietnam War hero, had actually struck his rebellious daughter in the face and physically forced a lump of meat into her mouth, that was something else. However much he thought back on it, he couldn't convince himself that it had actually happened. It was more like a scene from some bizarre play. More vivid and frightening than any other was the memory of the scream that had erupted from his sister-in-law when the lump of meat approached her lips. After spitting it out, she'd snatched up the fruit knife and glared fiercely at each of her family in turn, her terrified eyes rolling like those of a cornered animal. Once the blood was gushing out of her wrist, he'd torn a strip from one of their quilts, bound it around her wrist, and picked her up, her body so light she could almost have been a ghost. As he ran down to the car park, he'd been surprised by the speed and decisiveness of his own actions, something he'd never before realized he was capable of. As he watched her unconscious form receive emergency medical treatment, he'd heard a sound like something snapping inside his own body. The feeling he'd had at that moment was one that, even now, he found himself unable to explain with any degree of accuracy. A person had attacked her own body right in front of his eyes, tried to hack at it like it was a piece of meat. Her blood had soaked his white shirt, mingling with his sweat and gradually drying to a dark brown stain. He remembered hoping she would survive, but at the same time doubting just what that survival would mean. The moment she tried to take her own life had been a turning point. Now there was nothing anyone could do to help her. Every single one of them, her parents who had force-fed her meat, her husband and siblings who had stood by and let it happen, were distant strangers if not actual enemies. If she woke up again, that situation wouldn't have changed. Just because this suicide attempt had been spur of the moment didn't mean she wouldn't try it again. And if she did, no doubt she'd be more careful in how she went about it, and that meant there mightn't be anyone to stop her as there had been this time. All of a sudden, he became aware of the conclusion.